Good afternoon and welcome to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We're live in the studio here with Simon Allison and Greg Nicholson and myself, the host, Tilly Sharalambos. Voices for Braille and faces for radio, if you could call that the Daily Maverick team here today. We'll be covering current affairs from around the world, things that are happening in South Africa, the major news stories carried by the Daily Maverick. And I think we'll start off today with a bit of a wrap-up of happenings on the African continent. Simon Allison, our resident Africa expert, what are the major stories you're following at the moment?
Well, there's a great story that's just broken. Well, it's not a great story. Sorry, let me preface this. This is a terrible story.
Great story for a journalist.
It is what journalists always do.
Yeah, it is.
Tragedies is a great story.
Exactly. We have this problem of an obsession with carnage and wreckage and... all the things we really don't want to happen, but that's what we need for good stories. So in Libya at the moment, there's crazy fighting happening between two rival militias in the capital Tripoli. They've shut down the airport because of the fighting, you know, not because they wanted to shut it down, but because the runway is no longer usable. And now they've just set fire to the biggest fuel depot in the capital.
Set fire.
So, right. And I mean, this is an oil-producing country, so they have a lot of fuel in their depots, like, it's a massive fire. It's so big that Italy are just across the Mediterranean from Libya. Italy is sending firefighters to help combat this blaze because they can't deal with it themselves. They need help from another country to put out their own fires.
And I think companies must be freaking out.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a lot of speculation that the whole Libyan intervention was for the oil companies, was to secure those oil interests for French and Italian companies in particular. That has clearly backfired, I think. We can all agree on that. Libya's not producing a lot of oil at the moment. And what it does produce, it only produces when the various rival militant groups allow it to do so, you know, because they are the ones who are largely in control of the oil fields and the production facilities. So it is this crazy situation where you have a government that isn't in control of anything. They have no power. And
we spoke about this last week on the show that, you know, the government is now looking to other militia to protect state assets from militia.
And it's this, you know, it's this race to the bottom of when you start arming people and everyone's got guns, then no one is safe. And I think that's what we're seeing in Libya at the moment, and it's really getting bad.
Sorry, if they're burning the oil fields and there's not much production, how is the government running? Because A lot of the money in Libya comes from oil, right?
It does. Well, I don't think the government is really providing much in the way of services. So when you're not providing any services and you have no real control, your costs are actually quite minimal. Libyan government is essentially a parliament building and a suite at one of the 5-star Libyan hotels, which is where the prime minister lives. That's about it. And I think
even
that's
then,
as far as their influence. Yeah, their expense account doesn't go that far. Also, there's no alcohol in that minibar, so it's not that tempting anyway.
Of course.
Although perhaps they need that. Perhaps, yeah. If I was the Libyan Prime Minister right now, I think a bit of alcohol would go a long way.
I'd like to chat about the new outbreak of Ebola that seemed to be taking up. And we'll do this when we get Rebecca Davis on the line in a couple of minutes from Cape Town, who covered the story for the Daily Maverick. But there's other things happening on in Zambia. I mean, there's always things happening in Zambia that you wanted to chat about.
No, I think Kenya.
Oh, Kenya, right, silly. Sorry. Yeah, you're Kenya, Zambia, it's all one country, right?
Kenya has just announced a 4% drop in tourism arrivals for the first 5 months of this year. So that's not a good sign. Like, you don't want to be losing tourists. Of course, it's not hard to figure out why they're losing tourists. Most Western countries have issued a travel advisory against Kenya, saying, look, it's not safe to go to certain parts of Kenya, especially the cool tourist parts on the coast, resort islands like Lamu, historic cities like Mombasa. These are some of the most dangerous areas. But so the government have said, look, we've lost 4%, which amounts to something like 19,000 less visitors than this time last year. One of the major hotel companies has come out and said bullshit. The government is just pulling these numbers out of its ass. We can say this on this radio channel. I love it. And
they're over exaggerating the drop?
No, that they're under exaggerating the drop.
Oh, right. So it's actually worse than it is.
It's actually way worse. So this hotel group is saying, and they've got some lovely quotes here. It was a very well phrased email. It was titled 4% drop in tourism. We must be joking. And it went on to say that actually the figures are more like 20 to 30% and as much as 50% in some sectors.
A 4% drop is kind of what I think a lot of major tourist destinations around the world are sort of feeling anyway in terms of the global economic recession and the challenges that it's normal, right? The contraction, recession,
absolutely.
Normal recessionary effect, you know, of the financial crisis.
You can live with 4%,
yeah.
But you can't live with 20 to 50%. That's just crazy numbers.
Have we seen a corresponding drop in Kenya's GDP or growth?
I don't think we're going to see those figures for a while.
Okay.
Because this is sort of, I think we can trigger the marker of when Kenya became less attractive to the Westgate attacks. Mm. Because that just made such big international headlines. But all throughout this year, there have been attacks on resort towns. There have been a few tourists involved in the incidents. And eventually it's got to a point where Western governments were like, no, we can't encourage our citizens to be taking.
And it seems, I mean, it does seem a little bit strange that the attacks on Westgate, because it's the kind of facility that would have been frequented by expats and tourists as well. That compared to the kind of media coverage that the resorts and the towns or the villages that are being attacked got way more attention, and also sort of brought it home for for the expats and the tourists, is saying that, okay, it's not just those outlying rural areas. These are places where we could very likely have been where things like this are happening, and that probably triggered the collapse.
Yeah, there's a direct correlation between media coverage and location. So if it had been a similar siege on, say, a government building in rural Kenya, we would never have known about it because the journalists aren't there.
Mm.
But it's in Nairobi, and that's where the journalists are. That's where the cameras are. I've often thought, and Greg, maybe you can comment on this, if Marikana had happened in the Eastern Cape, say, not somewhere that was an hour and a half out of Joburg, you know, it's so easy for the entire nation's media to get there.
Mm.
If it had happened further away, I don't think we would know anything about it.
It wouldn't have been on cameras, that's for sure. And I've often thought about that in terms of service delivery protests, places like Bekkersdal. You know, you saw Bekkersdal sort of put up as this symbol as a hotbed of violence before the elections, and everyone's wondering what's going to go on. But it was very much like any other service delivery protest in the whole country. And Bekkersdal was an area or a township like many other places. Mm. But for some reason, it got all this attention. And I think that's largely because it's so close to Johannesburg.
Accessibility.
That's right.
Well, I mean, if you think, like you say, we wouldn't have had video footage of Marikana if it was down in the east, some rural part of the Eastern Cape. And it's very likely that the work that the Daily Maverick did wouldn't have happened. The exposure, the second copy, all that stuff wouldn't happen, because as a small news house ourselves, we wouldn't have had the resources to have. I mean, I remember back, we had almost the entire team working for 2 weeks solid. Almost everyone that was available was there, and for us to have the resources to send someone down to rural Eastern Cape, we would have never uncovered that story.
That's right.
Just taking it back to Kenya for a second, I was at the Manel Media Exchange conference over the weekend, and I happened to meet and bump into Robin Creel, who's the bureau chief for ENCA.
She's great. She does some great stuff.
Yeah, she really does. And I was talking to her about the region, and she says it's, you know, her job is really hectic as the East Africa bureau chief. There's a hell of a lot of traveling to be done. But this kind of comes back to your point about how bad things have become in Kenya. She says in the beginning when they went and they set up, I think it was 5 years ago, Kenya was boring. Kenya was, was kind of so stable here. And, you know, there are a couple of tech stories and a couple of, good, fast band, bandwidth and broadband. And, those are the kind of stories that were coming out of Kenya and M-Pesa and all those kind of things. And having to travel quite a bit, which was, really interesting part of her job, but going to all these other conflict areas to get, the kind of news that was driving the agenda.
A hub for some of the other conflict areas around.
But now, she says they're actually doing a lot more local stories because that's how much, terrorist activities have increased in Kenya. So they're actually saving a lot on budget on travel, which is yay for ENCA, bad for Kenya.
That's actually a fascinating anecdote to illustrate the problems. But I'm very, very worried about Kenya. You also spent a bit of time in Kenya, Greg.
I did. And what I find quite interesting about Kenya is it's not just Al-Shabaab and the attacks there. There's also, they've got their own, I guess you'd say, inter-tribal or inter-ethnic sort of violence and tension that's really, really serious. They've got a lot of challenges on multiple fronts.
Well, the Mpeketoni attacks, there were, oh God, when were they? I lose track.
A few weeks ago.
A few weeks or months ago. And, you know, when gunmen raided a village very near Lamu and shot up dozens of people. Those were attributed to Al-Shabaab initially. And now what the government's saying is, no, it wasn't Al-Shabaab. It was actually, they're saying that the local governor was involved, and it was all inter-tribal warfare, something to do with cattle raiding, I haven't been able to quite follow all the strands of it, but they're saying it wasn't Al-Shabaab. So it raises this question, you know, when things happen, so often, A, we will attribute it to Al-Shabaab if it's in Kenya, or we'll attribute it to Boko Haram if it's in Nigeria immediately, because these are the obvious suspects. And for these groups, it makes sense to claim it too, even if they weren't involved, you know. Here's an attack. We didn't actually have to risk anything, but we'll still get all the credit for it. It's a no-brainer. But you do wonder, a lot of these, is it actually these groups? You know, is it a plan? Has it been, you know, has Al-Shabaab sat down and said, we're going to attack here now? Or are they just taking advantage of existing local tensions? And the reason this is important is because it affects the solution. So because Al-Shabaab are making such a noise in Kenya, this is now justifying a horrendous crackdown from the government on Kenya's Somali population, which is big. Mm. Not just Somalis who live in Kenya, but also ethnic Somalis who are Kenyan. Mm. These are Kenyan citizens. And there have been horrific reports of arbitrary detention, forced removal from their house, you know, police knocking on doors at 3 in the morning, turfing out the whole family, arresting the husband and putting him into prison with no charge or no real prospect of release. Now, this is essentially turning Kenya into a police state in many respects, and the justification for this is, well, we're fighting Al-Shabaab. But what if it's not all Al-Shabaab? What if there are all these other factors that are in fact being ignored?
Mm-hmm. And even if it is Al-Shabaab, I'm not sure if it's a tactic that's going to work. I think it just might foment anger among the Somali and Somali-Kenyan communities.
It's not going to work. It has never worked, and it's not going to work in the future. And I find this very frustrating, watching African governments deal with counterterrorism, because they just repeat the same mistakes as before. And you do wonder, again, these guys aren't stupid, you know. Uhuru Kenyatta, the president of Kenya, is an incredibly intelligent man. You know, everyone I know who's met him, I've never met him myself, but they all say, this guy knows what he's doing. I mean, he was the son of the founder of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta. He had the best education going. He really knows his stuff. And this is what he is deciding to do. You know, he is deciding to crack down on Somalis. Is it because he thinks it's going to solve the problem? Or is it because it's going to improve his own personal standing? You know, it's going to entrench himself politically. And I kind of suspect that that's the case, that creating a police state makes it a lot easier for Kenyatta to stay in power for longer. And that's what he's doing.
And, of course, in Kenya at the same time, we have the return of Raila Odinga and this Saba Saba mess. So Kenyatta is under political pressure himself about keeping his presidency.
Absolutely.
Simon, what's the AU doing about this? I mean, you know, we've always talked about the AU as being somewhat of a, you know, a dog without a bite.
I'd love to know what the AU is doing about this. If only the AU would say something.
What does
about
the AU do?
Or about anything.
What does the AU do? I mean, you know, it's got nice fancy offices in Addis.
Chinese built.
But, you know, if we look back at the legacy of the AU, I mean, can we look back and find something, you know, concrete, worthwhile? What is the highlight, or what is the, you know, the peak of, or the pinnacle of what the AU has done for the continent?
There were some brilliant speeches when the OAU was formed. there were some brilliant speeches in what was that, 62, 63?
Yes. Yeah.
So since then, who knows?
Since then, it's all been downhill, hasn't it? Look, I think the AU does a lot of work behind the scenes on the smaller issues that we don't really know much about, you know,
facilitating funding
stuff
and
like, you know, the dispute between Tanzania and Malawi over Lake Malawi, and orchestrating ways that the continent should be doing stuff. Like, one of their big initiatives is to improve data collection in Africa, and this is a, you know, incalculably important initiative, because right now we don't have a clue how many poor people there are on this continent. The stuff that the UN uses to calculate numbers of people living in poverty, some of those figures are from 20 years ago, and they keep being up, you know, they keep being included in the latest reports. They keep being, you know, we just don't know.
Yeah, and they can set you off in completely the wrong direction.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
You can't measure it, you can't manage it. You
know? Exactly. So there's a lot of smaller initiatives that the AU is trying to get a grip on, and there are a lot of exceptionally talented people that work for the AU in the AU Commission. The problem comes with the big, high-profile conflict stuff, because ultimately the AU doesn't have money and it doesn't have military force. So it is completely dependent on the whim of member states to contribute militarily and on the whim of Western nations to give them money to deal with these things. That's why you see a big African Union force in Somalia, because America has helped facilitate funding for AMISOM in Somalia because they want someone to be fighting Al-Shabaab. It's part of the war on terror. But we haven't seen the same money put forward by anyone for the Central African Republic, because that's not as strategically important. So the AU is really hamstrung in a lot of ways. And you've got to never forget, AU is a democracy. It's a representative institution whose members are the 54 heads of state of African countries, very few of which subscribe to the values of democracy, human rights, and peaceful conflict resolution that we want the AU to be putting forward. And that's ultimately the problem, is maybe it shouldn't be a representative body.
Well, you know, the other way of looking at it is, if you look at the hassles and the trials and tribulations that the EU itself has been going through, and that's with a lot fewer members, and obviously being in Europe and the majority of those all being classified as, they are all first world countries. And the challenges that the EU has as an organization. Now imagine a much bigger set of members involved in a much bigger continent-wide organization. It's almost as if it's hiding to nothing that you're just going to fail.
Absolutely,
and you know, is it not more of a an incentive to have regionalized versions of the AU that can have concentrated, more focused, and more focused?
Well, those exist. You know, your SADCs, your ECOWAS, yeah. Your East African community. The East African community in particular is quite visionary. They're trying to break down borders, break down visa regulations. So someone from Kenya can now go work in Rwanda without needing a new special visa, which is, that's fantastic. But another key difference between the EU and the AU is that the EU's, you have to qualify for the EU. So it started as, I can't remember, it started as a tiny handful of nations.
No, it started as Germany and France after the war.
Was that it?
Yep.
To link, was a steel trade agreement, actually.
Okay.
That's where it started, to try and link, always tied Germany's development to France. And so Germany would never be able to become another superpower that could try and take over the world again, because all of their production is actually now linked to France at the same time, and it grew from there.
That makes sense.
And the first record of a notion of a single currency for the continent was actually forwarded by Napoleon, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
You know, obviously dates back, and so the thinking's also been there for quite a long time.
So with the EU, you've got all this long history, and you've also got this idea that, you know, it started with France and Germany, and they slowly added members who qualify for their criteria.
And it's a long process. It takes about 10 years worth of getting your economic and legal policies in line with that of the with that of the EU, in order to create that stability going forward, so you don't have rogue member states who don't have laws or don't have economics in place that are going to have you so out of whack with the rest. Not that it did a lot of these new member states really
any good. No.
You know, and I'm thinking, obviously, thinking close to home, Cyprus went through that whole process, and, you know, years later after joining, is in a state of almost financial ruin.
So that's interesting. How would it work in Africa if we were to put in a similar model? Say South Africa and Ghana were to start their own union and not let anyone else in until they were good enough, until they met the standards. South Africa and Ghana are the only ones I can think of who are economically viable and, you know, politically viable. Maybe Zambia, perhaps.
I think it would work better, but the problem is actually getting to that stage where you can sign an agreement and sacrifice a slither of your sovereignty, and in partnership with another country. And I think that's the key problem.
The biggest difficulty that we'd have in this is to say, well, we're using the EU as a template, and there'll be, you know, a lot of countries pointing to the recent failures of the EU,
exactly.
And say, well, how can we use that as a template?
And that's a very valid criticism. You know, the EU is a work in progress, and it's an experiment that no one's quite sure if it's going to work out or not. So maybe this whole focus we have on regional integration is misguided. We should all be looking after ourselves.
Well, geez, like you said, the East African community, I think, is in some respects has done some really good stuff. And I think free trade and free movement of labor, I think, is also going to help, you know, increase the productivity and competitiveness of each of these member countries. Now, we've got Rebecca Davis on the line from Cape Town. Hi, Bex. How are you?
Not too bad in yourself, Timmy.
Cool. Thanks. We've got a couple of stories I'd like to chat to you about today. The first one is Ebola. You and Simon have done some work on this, so I'll let you guys take it away.
It's a nice, fun topic. Oh, sorry, yeah. Rebecca, this is Greg.
I said yesterday that Simon and I would probably whip each other into a frenzy of paranoia about Ebola, since I think we share similar fears about it.
Right, okay, so Bex, let's just start at the beginning. We're sitting here in South Africa. How scared should we be?
In my personal opinion, very, but in the opinion of experts, not particularly.
Rebecca, are you currently sitting there in a quarantine suit?
Are we only worried about this now because some American doctor got infected with the virus and now we should be worried?
No, there is good reason in general to be concerned about this particular outbreak because it is the largest and most widespread outbreak of Ebola in recorded history. Over 670 people have died thus far, and it has spread to three African countries thus far, which is Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, whereas previous Ebola outbreaks have been highly localized and have burnt out really quickly. And an expert told me yesterday that sort of tragically and awfully, that's often because survivors actually flee the area. But in this case, that hasn't happened. It does seem to be spreading. And the consensus seems to be that it will certainly be raging for another few months, if not longer.
And I also heard there was one confirmed case in Lagos, which is terrifying. Lagos is a city of however many million people living in extraordinarily cramped circumstances.
I mean, this really is the stuff of the beginning of an apocalyptic movie. This guy gets on a plane from Liberia. He has a layover in Togo. He interacts with many people, over 50 people at least he comes into contact with on his trip, arrives at Lagos Airport, one of the world's most densely populated cities, and he collapses. He has Ebola. So that's obviously terrifying because, as I said, in a metropolis like Lagos, if he were to have just disappeared into that city, the chances of it spreading, I mean, it's a very, very, very alarming thought. And the other obviously alarming thing is that he was able to jump on a plane and cross borders. There's been some suggestion that he claimed he was not aware that he was infected before he got on a plane. But it seems quite clear that the whole reason he got on a plane was to try and seek superior medical care in Nigeria. And unfortunately, you just can't do that when you are infected. This is one of the really kind of devastating things about the illness. When you are infectious, you cannot be getting on a plane because if other passengers come into contact with traces of your vomit, for instance, or your feces, because at that stage you will be vomiting, you might be vomiting blood, you might have diarrhea, then unfortunately the exposure is really, really dangerous. So the good thing about Ebola is that you can't catch it through really casual contact. You can't catch it like SARS, you can't catch it like a cold. You do have to have contact with bodily fluids, sweat, blood, saliva, etc. And that has to happen through you having some kind of piercing in your skin, but it can also be contracted through your mucous membranes, through your nose, etc., etc. The main worry for us in South Africa, according to health experts, is precisely the scenario that happened in Lagos, that there will inevitably be wealthier people across the continent who become infected, and then knowing that the best place on the continent to seek medical care is South Africa, will jump on a plane and come to Johannesburg to try to seek treatment. And this is exactly what happened in 1996, when a Gabonese doctor who had treated an Ebola patient became infected, became sick, jumped on a plane to Joburg, went to a private clinic. He actually survived, but the South African nurse who treated him died. So now that's what we have to be on high alert for. And the NCID, which is the National Institute of Communicable Diseases, has sent out alerts to all South African healthcare facilities. But it's the airports that really are the ones who have to be the first line of defense against this. Because if somebody's coming off a plane who appears to have a hemorrhagic fever, they need to be detained and isolated right there. They need to be taken away into an isolation center. Somebody who's an infectious disease specialist needs to see them immediately. Their blood needs to be tested and so forth. They can't be allowed just to swan out into the general environment.
Bex, doesn't this point to a failure from the on the part of the authorities. You think that the airport in Liberia, that they would be screening people, making sure that, that no one leaves the country that, that may even have the potential to have Ebola. Why is this not happening?
Yeah, it certainly does speak to a failure in that regard. And I believe that Liberian President Ellen Sirleaf Johnson has now cracked down. Only one airport is now open. Various other borders have been closed, but still too late. So either it's a case of just a lack of ignorance about the dangers involved, or a general sort of chaotic systems, or the fact that perhaps there are not the right knowledgeable people to do that kind of scanning. OR Tambo, for instance, now has infrared thermal machine scanners, which can scan international passengers arriving to see if their temperatures are raised. But obviously it's unlikely, to my knowledge, that Liberia has these kind of facilities. And then the other problem, which I think you might know more about, Simon, is that healthcare workers in these West African countries are just under enormous strain at the moment. Some of the local healthcare workers have fled because they fear, correctly, that they could be infected, and healthcare workers are certainly most at risk of contracting Ebola. And others are being prevented from doing their jobs because locals seem to believe, allegedly, that it is health care workers themselves who are spreading the disease. So in some cases, they're being banned from entering villages and so on. It's obviously enormously unhelpful, and one of the things that's going to make this outbreak so intractable.
You know, I've also spoken to a few experts in this field, and what they keep saying is Ebola is not some like crazy disease that rages beyond our control. It's very much a disease that humans have the capacity to control and contain. But the problem is, and once again, it's governance and leadership and simple organization, that the mechanisms to do so are not in place. And a few healthcare workers have told me that there is just chaos in Liberia at the moment, with all kinds of different groups. You've got Doctors Without Borders, you've got the World Health Organization, you've got America's Center for Disease Control. They've all got big teams out there. They're all trying to help, but they're all doing different things and sometimes doing the same things. And there's no coordination from the Liberia's own Ministry of Health. So it really is a very chaotic situation. And then compounding this... Sorry, Bex, go on.
No, please.
Compounded.
Well, I was just going to say, Simon, that obviously what this is exposing is, I mean, in a positive way, I guess, is the generalized problem with public health systems in Africa. So if it shines some light on that, then that's a good thing. But the other issue, obviously, is the fact that a lot of these outbreaks have been happening in very poorly resourced rural areas where there just isn't the necessary equipment or staff to deal with it.
No, absolutely. And the thing about locals being distrustful of healthcare workers, you can kind of understand it, you know. People have been getting fevers for as long as anyone can remember, and suddenly they get sent off to a treatment center and they come back with Ebola, or they die from Ebola.
Absolutely. And I think one of the other stigmatizing factors about this disease is the terrible precautions you have to take with dead bodies, because dead bodies are still infectious. So I can't even imagine how traumatic it is to have a loved one die of Ebola, and then for whatever cultural reason, you do not want to cremate them, which would be ideal. And you have to attend their funeral with everyone wearing basically full hazmat gear with goggles, face shields, gowns. I mean, what a terrible way to have to say goodbye to someone.
Well, not only is that not happening, but I've heard that some of the local customs require that the body is washed before it's actually buried. So you have people interacting with the body, you know, laying their hands all over the body. And there have been some instances of people breaking into healthcare facilities and stealing the bodies that have been quarantined because they want to give them a proper burial. And yeah, and you can understand, you know, these are the local customs and traditions, but how incredibly dangerous is that?
Yeah, it's the terrifying amount of ignorance around this. And, you know, our sense of security here, right here wrongly, is coming from the idea that we in South Africa do have much better healthcare facilities, we have better coordination. And I was assured by an expert yesterday that even if somebody were to circumvent all the necessary border controls and enter into South Africa and immediately go to a private clinic, we still wouldn't face some kind of raging epidemic on our hands, because that person would be, you know, isolated and the problem would be contained. But I see actually that another doctor has left a comment on my article today claiming that the public hospitals in Johannesburg actually would be quite unlikely to manage because isolation facilities and equipment are often lacking. So I don't know whether now I've been lulled into a false sense of security. Yeah.
And would doctors even recognize it? I mean, someone comes in with a strange tropical fever.
This is what I was just about to ask. What are the early symptoms? Because I'm sitting here going, oh yeah, Greg's got a bit of a sniffle over there in the corner. You know, how far away should I be sitting from the guy?
In general, you should avoid Greg's bodily fluids, I think.
As a general rule of thumb, yes.
The problem is exactly that it presents early on, pretty much like flu or malaria, and even in its kind of getting worse forms, it can still look like severe malaria if you're, you know, sweating and trembling and nauseous and so forth. And it can also look like any other hemorrhagic fever. And in South Africa, we have had instances of other imports of hemorrhage, of different forms of hemorrhagic fever, Marburg virus, and another terrifying thing called the Lugo virus, which has also come into our country before. So yeah, you're going to have incredibly knowledgeable infectious disease specialists looking at practically everyone coming through the border who looks to be remotely ill. And as Dr. said, the other problem is that you obviously don't want to turn away anyone coming here with a treatable illness who is just looking, as is their human right, for the best healthcare. So, you know, it's obviously hideous to have to come with this extremely suspicious attitude towards anyone who might be remotely sick. But unfortunately, in circumstances like this, I don't see any alternative.
And Bex, and this is presumably why it has such a high strike rate, like 90% of people who get infected, you know, end up dying, because it's really hard to pick up the early symptoms. And once they do, you kind of pass the point of no return.
Yeah, it can incubate for up to 3 weeks. But once you're infected and once you're infectious, I mean, it is tickets very, very rapidly, which isn't to say that every case is fatal, but there is no cure. So from when you start kind of vomiting, bleeding, and you bleed both internally and externally, if you've ever Google imaged Ebola, and I would highly not recommend it, you'll see just how horrific this virus really is. And that's certainly one of the reasons why we're so scared of it, because I can't think of another illness that just manifests itself so brutally and so kind of dramatically and just kills you in such a short space of time.
Greg is literally Googling Ebola.
I am.
And the expression on his face says it all.
No, I haven't got there yet. It's taking a while. But okay, it's loading, so you guys can just hold on. Holy.
Bex, do we know anything about what causes Ebola? You know, I mean, the origins of the disease.
It just seems to come. The hosts of the virus seem to be forest animals. So, new research last year suggested it was mainly fruit bats, but I think it can also be carried by chimpanzees and other primates. So the issue is, I believe that in many of these kind of rural West African countries, for instance, bat soup is a common delicacy. People eat bush, they eat primates and so on. And that's the way that humans initially become infected, by coming into direct contact with an infected animal's meat. And the unfair part of it is that bats apparently can carry the Ebola virus and live quite happily. It doesn't even affect them.
Well, if there are anyone listening to us or listening to this podcast or live streaming in those high-risk areas, I would just like to put it out there that the UK has much better healthcare facilities than South Africa and should direct their attentions there.
Also send in your favorite bat soup recipe, please.
Yeah. Not to make light of a very, very serious thing that's happening. Bex, just before we let you go and to earn your keep for the day, political funding for our parties. Another topic that you wrote about recently, and something that seems to be the only thing that our political parties seem to agree on, all right, is not disclosing their funders.
Absolutely. So there's currently no mechanism in South Africa which obliges political parties to disclose who gives them all the fat donations that sustain them. There are parties who do it voluntarily. For instance, I think the African Christian Democratic Party does lay open its books for scrutiny.
So the ones that don't really matter, right?
Exactly, that's right. The only the small fry. The big parties just will not say who funds them, and it's something they're agreed upon. But this is not the case in the rest of the world at all. There's about 60 countries, and in particular, most of what we would call the established democracies do have a rule that you have to disclose funding above a certain threshold, which varies quite drastically. For instance, in the US, you have to declare everything above $200, which is obviously very small. In the UK, it's much higher, it's £7,500. But the consensus seems to be that it is really important to do this, because you can demonstrate to the public that your policies are not being dictated by private business interests. As it stands, we have no concept of what kind of policies are being pushed through by political parties on the whim of their donors, you know, and that's the really frightening part.
I remember at the gathering that we held earlier this year, which was the election-focused gathering, and we had the panel on the stage with the likes of Helen Zille, Pilar Mpela, Malusi Gigaba, and Zwelin Zimavavi. And this issue of political funding came up, and it was addressed to Helen Zille. And, you know, she was asked, and, you know, why doesn't the DA disclose? And she said, well, the biggest reason is that if her funders were disclosed, that they would come under such pressure from the ANC and the government that that party funding could very likely dry up as an effect of the undue influence that could be exerted on those funders via the government and via the various mechanisms of the government. So, you know, and I was sitting there thinking, yeah, it's really great, we should know. And then I was thinking, actually, there is some merit to that argument.
Yeah, this is Helen Zille's claim that it will definitely damage opposition politics in South Africa. And as you say, Silly, I think we can intuitively suspect that there might be something behind that, particularly when we see, for instance, how when FNB, for instance, ran a sort of mildly anti-ANC ad campaign with kids complaining about various things, they were threatened with the loss of government contracts and so forth. Having said that, there is no direct evidence that the DA would suffer donation-wise from funding transparency. And the Council for the Advancement of the Constitution last year pointed out that when Anglo Gold Ashanti came out and said, look, we, in the interest of transparency, we're telling you that we fund the DA, Khalema Motlanthe at the time congratulated them on a principled position. So it would kind of be an article of faith, and it's certainly something we shouldn't take lightly. Even scholars who agree that in general funding transparency is a good thing warn that particularly in emerging democracies, if there will be repercussions to smaller parties, then the disadvantages could outweigh the advantages.
Why do you think the ANC and the EFF don't want to disclose their funders?
I mean, I dread to think. Honestly, Celia, I dread to think. I mean, we just don't know what kind of people they're receiving money from. And obviously, the conspiracy theory last year was that the EFF, for instance, was getting money from Mugabe or Mugabe-aligned forces, which presumably wouldn't be perhaps particularly good PR for them. Although, on the other hand, perhaps the kind of people who vote for the EFF would not be particularly alarmed by that. But, I mean, the very fact that they don't want to disclose, particularly the ruling party, which would seem to have little to lose, suggests to me that there may well be you know, troubling relationships happening there.
Some skeletons in the closet, perhaps. Greg?
Interestingly, at the same time, I know you mentioned that the former deputy president, Khalema Motlanthe, had sort of praised the position of people wanting to open their books. And also I've heard Matthews Poser has also taken a similar position in the past, former Treasurer General of the ANC. And Zweli Mkhize even has had some sort of similar sentiment before. But it sort of seems like a stalemate at the moment where no one's really going to open their books, and you know, unless the ANC does or unless laws change. But I think what's interesting is this new group, My Vote Counts, they want to go to the Constitutional Court to try and force political parties to open their books. Do they have any chance, Bex? And is that the only hope?
It's a tough one because it's been tried before. IDASA, the Institute for Democracy, Advancement of Democracy in South Africa, approached the court in the mid-2000s and was slapped down, although the judge at the time did acknowledge that it was probably time that funding reform happened in some way. But the point of the judge in that case was that he did not feel that the disclosure of funding was a prerequisite to free and fair elections, which, I mean, is a point we can argue. This time round, they're going at it arguing, as they did last time, but in a sort of slightly differently angled way, as far as I understand it, that it is a basic precept of our Constitution that access to information is necessary, and again, that the right to vote cannot be considered a truly informed vote until you know who's funding. What I'm a bit dubious about in this situation is that we've seen increasing instances of judges over the past years arguing that the judiciary should not be dragged into solve political disputes or parliamentary procedural debates even. So I'm interested to see how the Constitutional Court bench will rule on this one, given that there does seem to be that general antipathy from judges.
Rebecca Davis, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We look forward to chatting to you again soon. And
thanks
so much. We'll chat to you again next time. Greg, before we go and wrap up things for today, I'd like to chat to you about the end of the NUMSA strike now. Do we have a strike-free South Africa for the immediate future? How long before the next one comes around? You know, what are your thoughts, having been through and followed the NUMSA or the recent NUMSA engineering strike?
Do we ever have a strike-free South Africa?
Well, you know, that's hopefully we can have a short brief period or a brief grace period from what's been going on.
Well, at the moment, there were no other big strikes coming up immediately soon. But thoughts, you know, it only sort of ended yesterday. My immediate thoughts are I think the workers got a very good deal. NUMSA pushed the metal bargaining, the SAFSA, the metal and engineering industries quite hard. So lowest paid workers got 10% increases for 3 years, 10% for each of 3 years, which is, you know, you're talking almost 4% above inflation. It's quite good. The higher paid workers got 8%, but the key thing is whether these, with these big pushes, and this largely I think stems from the platinum strike where AMCU, with the three big platinum producers, were able to get quite high increases, sort of set the bar for NUMSA. Mm-hmm. And NUMSA, like AMCU, is quite a militant union. They've got quite socialist, use socialist rhetoric and talk about changing the continuing colonial apartheid wage structure. And because of the bar set from AMCU, I think they needed to really, really push things here. But I think in the end, it was quite a reasonable deal, and both parties, both employer bodies and NUMSA, fought very hard, but they came out with sort of a compromise. The thing that everyone's looking at today is there's another employer body, one called NYASA, and I think it's got, I can't remember how many thousands, but it's thousands and thousands of small and medium-sized enterprises that their employer body aren't the biggest employer body, employer association in the industry, and so they have to take what they can get from the bigger employer body. So once the Labor Minister applies this sort of collective bargaining agreement to the whole industry, and this the body NYASA doesn't want to accept the deal that's been made because they didn't agree to it, and they say they can only afford 8% increases. And sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
And it sort of creates a quite a difficult problem because the CEFSA, they cover many sort of medium-sized and very large businesses, and their companies are more likely to be able to afford it. But these smaller companies don't have a choice in taking that matter, and they're just going to have to pay these workers unless they can prove that they're basically going to go broke if they do.
The rumors of a workers' party seem to have subsided. Have you felt that it's kind of sort of gone off the boil at the moment? Is it still kind of working in the background? The mechanics,
most definitely is.
The wheels are still in motion.
It's only gone off the boil because we're focusing on, we're asking the NUMSA leaders about the strike instead of their workers' party for a month or so. But it's still there. They're still working at it. They've got guys on the ground pulling together all these different type of left-leaning and socialist organizations, working quite hard to build up what they're calling their United Front.
And are there any timelines on where they'd when they'd like to see something more concrete, what was a hang to start with, a political platform.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's what it seems to be that they're almost doing right now. They're still hesitant to say that they're setting up a party, but there's been suggestions from the leaders that they may look to contest the 2016 municipal elections. So I think we're going to see some bigger events coming up soon that they're planning, especially now this big strike's out of the way. Mm-hmm. They're going to put their attention onto this sort of setting up their movement for socialism. And we'll see some big events soon. And hopefully after that, they'll probably take some decisions, you know, as everything has to be adopted through congresses and whatnot. And then we could see an announcement that they will establish a political party. But the NUMSA leaders are... They're not great friends with the ANC or some Kasatu leaders or the SACP. So I really, really wouldn't be surprised, and I actually expect them to establish a political party.
Does that stem from a feeling that the alliance has abandoned their mandate to look after the workers, or that they have failed the workers?
Yeah, not just workers. They obviously, NUMSA being a union, have to look out for Labor's interests and their members' interests. But like sort of Kasatu does, they also position themselves as, you know, vanguards of the poor, fighters for the working class. So working class, not just being the employed, but often unemployed, you know, the army of unemployed in South Africa too. And they really position themselves as, the rhetoric they use is that they're trying to fight for the sort of the forgotten South Africans, the people that have hardly benefited from democracy, and that expected and were promised so much more. Both from the ANC government coming into power in 1994 and things like the Freedom Charter in the 50s.
Yeah, so one thing we got to chat about before we wrap up the show, I think, is to touch on the one-year anniversary of the EFF. You know, it's, a couple of days ago, the EFF celebrated their one year of existence. And Ranjini Monsamire wrote a piece in the Daily Maverick about looking back at this, you know, this thing that was created out of nowhere, out of this, you know, out of this ideology and this firebrand that Julius and, you know, with them living up to their promises to rattle the status quo. And we've seen that in Parliament. We've seen that with them being chucked out of Parliament, their refusal to budge, you know, with the red overalls, the not greeting of parliamentary members in the appropriate titles and salutations. You know, they are certainly living up to their promise of being troublemakers. You know, what is the future here for the EFF? You can only go on gimmicks and tactics and, you know, things, you know, sort of PR pulling tactics for so long. You know, what's the next step for them in their evolution, do you think, Greg?
I actually think we might see more of the same for a little bit. And the reason I say that is because I think the ANC is helping them take these little platforms for these gimmicks and things, and they're giving them opportunity to have legitimate almost...
They're feeding them almost.
They right? are. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the issue with the overalls in the Gauteng legislature. When I think I was there, they have 8 MPLs in this legislature here, and they were forcefully kicked out by the police. There was dozens of police came in, and this is the start of the month, came into the, you know, the lawmaking body in this province. And because these guys were wearing overalls, and then when they're told by the speaker, Ndombi Mekwe, to leave, and they refused... Then the police came and literally ripped them out, and they broke one guy's arm. 2 other people also had to go to hospital. And we're talking about an elected representative in the legislature. Mm. Police broke his arm in the legislature.
And this was all before the march on the legislature happened. This is what led to the march.
That's why there was the march, right? Mm. And so because of that, of course, Julius Malema and his, you know, and his fighter comrades are going to march on the legislature, and they had valid reason to. Mm. What they could have also done is go to court and instead try to challenge the speaker's ruling there, but they didn't do that. They decided to grandstand and go for this bigger option.
Mm-hmm. And that works. People are tired of courts. People are tired of commissions. These things take so long. They're so boring. And I know that's not right because you know, our politics should not be decided on the basis of what's exciting and what's boring. Mm. But that is how the world works. You know, people respond to action. They respond to these things that Julius Malema is doing, you know, the little touches like the red overalls, that was absolute genius.
But we're also seeing in the likes of the service delivery protests in the build-up to the elections is that people felt they weren't being heard. So they were taking to violence, they were taking to protests, they were taking to real visible ways of protesting.
And I think Julius Malema's done really well, and I guess his other, the leadership of the EFF, they've done very well to really galvanize that sentiment and those sorts of people. I think when I was outside the Gauteng legislature last week, I was actually just going from one pub to the other, but then I got caught up.
As Greg does normally during the day.
I got caught up in this thing, and I had my camera on me, so I hung around. And so there were skirmishes, you know, rubber bullets, stun grenades going off and tear gas. And then I went with the police, and we ran after these guys, you know, these protesters, all the way into Park Station, you know, and the cops have their shotguns, and we're in Park Station, ready to shoot rubber bullets, trying to these fighters, and I sort of paused for a moment. I was thinking, how the hell did it come to this? Where did these guys come from, and how have we turned into this? But it's credit to the EFF, but they've really managed to organise a lot of these sort of people who are the type to engage in service delivery protests, and they're turning out for these events.
Yeah, and that was the biggest sort of accolade for the million people that they managed to get to vote for them in the last election was those were most likely people who probably wouldn't have bothered with the electioneering and voting and participating in the latest campaign.
And one of the interesting things that Julius Malema recently admitted was that one mistake they made in the lead up to the elections was they didn't push their constituency, young people enough, to get registered for the elections. Mm. And if they had, who knows? I think we could have seen a much larger result for the EFF.
Well, I don't think anyone's going to judge them on the 8 months of preparation that they basically had. So, you know, they could be forgiven for making a couple of mistakes within what was ultimately a very successful campaign for something that wasn't even around a year ago.
It's incredible. I remember someone saying that I think they've been around about the election time, the same month as the term of a pregnancy. You know, and it's sort of 9 months. It's incredible.
And that was the central focus of a book that is being published by Daily Merrick that is out in a couple of days' time.
Nice transition, Stilly.
Thank you. I've been working on it.
You've got that plug in there too.
Yeah. Until Julius comes, which was the central theme that came out of the entire election. You know, if you look back at the, you know, for Richard Poplack, who followed it from, you know, day one and who did a mess, you know, almost as much as you, Greg, in terms of, you know, driving around almost. And almost, not, you know, he's only human. and following their campaign closely. And ultimately, when we put this thing together, and you know, thinking of a name and a theme for the book, it could only have been Until Julius Comes, which is the main theme that came out here, regardless of the ANC winning by a big majority and the sort of the sideline spats between the DA and Agang, was the emergence of EFF.
I like that title because it also has a sort of messiah complex vibe about it, and I think that that's a big part of Julius's appeal. Is he really has developed a cult of personality. In a way that I don't think Zuma or Thabo Mbeki ever managed to achieve.
Thank God. I think it's quite interesting, though, that we've seen, I don't know if you guys know, but one of the deputy ministers in the presidency, Buti Manamala, also head of the Young Communist League, last week compared Juju to Adolf Hitler. And just today I've seen that ANC's Secretary General Gwede Mantashe has done the same. He says the Nazis didn't start by killing Jews. They started by making promises. So be careful of making promises, guys. You might be called Hitler.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. I'm sure I've heard Gwede make a couple of promises. We must make promises to the people.
And I mean,
that was terrible.
You know, yeah,
if we're going to go along with this Hitler analogy, Hitler was the most successful politician in Germany's history, I think. He was a brilliant exponent of democratic politics, of making democratic politics bend to his will.
And ultimately what he did was he took an entire nation that was hard done by suffering under the repercussions of the Treaty of Versailles and the war reparations that Germany had to do. And people were suffering. People were really crumbling under those pressures, and managed to galvanize them and move them in a direction. So I guess maybe that in that analogy, there might be some substance to it. But I think, our stance on this is that, you know, he's more of a Mussolini character than a Hitler character.
Yeah, let's just get clear.
Yeah.
Hitler was a dick.
Yeah. Hitler was a dick, but I'm sure that's what Buti and Gwede are trying to infer. Our time is up here today on the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. You can tune in every week at 1 o'clock to listen to us live, or you can catch the podcast on cliffcentral.com or Daily Maverick. We look forward to seeing you and talking with you next week. Cliffcentral.com.